It's our pleasure to have here today Roberto Huebner, professor from the Lutheran Center in Mexico City. He's on a study leave researching Lutheran Church Missouri Synod history of its mission work and policies in Latin America and in the Caribbean. As we said, he serves being stationed at Lutheran Center and serves there as missionary counselor for theological education in a number of countries besides Mexico, Guatemala, Honduras, Salvador, Panama, and Venezuela. Born of missionary parents in Argentina, He came to the States at age 14. He was a student at our Concordia High School in Milwaukee. Graduated from the college there and from St. Louis in 1952. His wife is here with us. Where is she? I just saw her. Margaret. Okay. We welcome you. They were married in 52, I believe. And he served in Caracas, Venezuela, for a number of years, has done some studies at the Pontifical Biblical Institute in Rome, was called to teach Old Testament at Augsburg Lutheran Seminary in Mexico City, became rector there the year before it closed in June of 81. And he can tell you about its closing with the dropping off of the supply of the number of students through the switch from resident theological education to TEE. But would you welcome with me Reverend Huebner?
To join in the singing at chapel. To join with you in the celebration of the Lord's Supper, to hear a classmate, Charles Knippel, present the word so beautifully, and another classmate, Wenyang Ji, lead us in questions if we are ready to receive the Lord's Supper worthily prepared by Dr. Martin Luther. What a privilege. Thank you for allowing one to share a bit of one's experience. October 12th, 1992, will mark the 500th anniversary of Christian presence in the Americas. Will it be a day of celebration or lamentation? 100 million Indians and blacks have perished since the conquest, while Europeans and also the United States has tried to develop Latin America in its image. But since the early 1960s, Latin Americans have ceased to be objects of history, but have taken an active role in being subjects of their history. At present, 95% of Latin Americans are baptized, yet only 15% practice the Christian faith. The Roman Catholic Church considers Latin America its biggest mission field. How to evangelize the baptized? Why should the Missouri Synod not look upon it as a mission field? At present, 20% are rich. Those who do not have to worry about tomorrow, unless inflation or devaluation takes their money away. At present, 80% are poor because they are not sure about tomorrow's income. At present, 50% of the 80% are extremely poor, living from hand to mouth. And 20% of the 80% are starving. Considering that there are close to 500 million people living in Latin America and the Caribbean, I am still somewhat traumatized by the closing of Augsburg Lutheran Seminary in June of 1981. How is it possible for an area that is growing 2.9% every year in population, that a place that was dedicated to the Lord to prepare people for ministry should have no longer a reason for being? It did train 33 persons for ministry in 16 years of its existence. I taught Old Testament courses since 1973 and was the last president of the seminary that served both ALC, the American Lutheran Church, and the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod as we prepared people for ministry that came from Venezuela, Colombia, Ecuador, Bolivia, Panama, El Salvador, Honduras, Costa Rica, Guatemala, Mexico. Some of these students are also, not only did they return to their countries, but are serving in the USA. Do I have to point out these countries? I guess we could do that at another moment. Huh? It is not the first closure of a Lutheran Church Missouri Synod theological institution in Mexico. Already in 1957, another theological experiment closed after preparing 10 or maybe 12 persons for ministry. That experiment, having started in 1947 by the Reverend Professor Fred Grocock, who then continued his ministry since 57 at Austin, Texas. But then we had another little experience in the history of Mexico. The Reverend Bernard Panco in 1945 was asked to begin theological education in Mexico. And 6 months later, another person was called to do the same thing by the name of Professor Rees from Winfield, Kansas. And because they couldn't find any students, in disappointment, Professor Rees returned again to the States. What points out is that we did things, and maybe we didn't really check into the total needs. We thought it was very interesting in following a pattern that we all knew, but maybe the bigger questions, whether what we were doing was really fitting into the situation, was the right thing and the right method. After the closing of our seminary in 81, we were advised to look into other Lutheran Church Missouri Synod seminaries in South America to seek help. San Leopoldo, Brazil. Way down here. Which had moved 20 miles from Porto Alegre. And that seminary had been opened in 1902, way down south, close to Uruguay, in a place called Bom Jesus, by a Reverend John Hartmeister. So from Bom Jesus, it went to Porto Alegre, and then San Leopoldo. So a seminary that's been in existence for 86 years now. And also to check out São Paulo, which has a 40-year history, but both teach in Portuguese. And remember that Brazil is the only Portuguese-speaking country in South America or in Latin America. And the rest of us speak Spanish or some French or some English, depending on where you are in the Caribbean islands. Buenos Aires, Argentina, was our other chance. Way down here. Which opened in 1942. That seminary teaches in Spanish. As we continue to analyze, and it's tremendous, once a thing has gone under, you know, as painful as it is, but you really struggle and you dialogue, you ask questions. What could have possibly been the reason and the cause that in the largest city of the world, 21 million people, and in a continent that is growing 2.9% a year, a seminary would close? Folks, that's traumatic. And the more we ask questions, those of us involved from Venezuela, from Colombia, from Panama, from Costa Rica, from Honduras, from Guatemala, El Salvador, and Mexico, even with the help of those who had their seminaries in Brazil and Argentina, we came to the sad conclusion that we think that the root of the problem is that the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod lacks a written mission policy. When I asked Dr. H.A. Mayer, the one who is somewhat instrumental for sending out both Margaret and myself to Venezuela 37 years ago, we asked him, Dr. Mayer, could you tell us by what policy did you work? What was the mission thinking that prevailed? What were the objectives that the mission board had in your time? I will never forget how he scratched his head. He's still a very lively individual, remember? Some of you have met him, 93 years old. All of a sudden he says, Bob, we didn't have any. We worked by gosh and by God. Sometimes it was the big war that moved us here, and sometimes it was a letter that we found in somebody's coat that moved us to open this work or do that work. And due to lack of a written mission policy, undoubtedly was the reason why our seminary closed, a residence program in Mexico City. But what we discovered all along, what we were really trying to do, was following a U.S. model that maybe wasn't really serving Latin America's needs. We then looked more seriously into theological education by extension, or I prefer the term open theological education, because theological education by extension can be confusing. First of all, one thinks that it is an extension of an existing institution, and that seminary extends itself, and that may be the case here in the United States. I think that this seminary has extension areas, right? Services that you render, right or not? So it really would be an extension of this seminary somewhere else in the United States. But in Mexico or in Latin America, it isn't necessarily so. Because if the extension seminaries had really been an extension of our seminary in Mexico City, all the other groups should have really fallen apart. And they didn't. The reason is they really existed simultaneously with a director, with a program, and with students. And even before our seminary closed, I was invited on several occasions to teach short courses, which means still 24 hours like you may have some of the courses here, you know, that are only taught maybe once every other day, an hour or so. So it was a full course, but it was just compressed into a week, depending on the time that the students had available. If you care, later on in time, I could describe a course that was being taught and how. So, during these sessions, and they can be sometimes with larger groups or smaller groups, sometimes it's on a one-by-one, especially if the student is a university graduate, a doctor or a lawyer, a person with even more, call it preparation, schooling, than I in some areas. So we should not think that theological education by extension is necessarily a lower level. It really can reproduce in us the greatest trauma to try to reach these individuals who have been trained in various areas, being lawyers or doctors or having served in the military, to try to reach them with the words in such a way and fashion that they can then be instruments of sharing the good news in the country and area in which they are. The Presbyterian Church in Guatemala switched from a residence program completely in 1963 and went to extension. With this, for them, happy result, that while they were continuing in their residence program, they had 5 students. When they switched to the open education theological method, they multiplied first in the first year to 20. In the next year, it just kept on mushrooming, so that in 5 years, they were serving 200 persons and training them for ministry. We in Venezuela had started with the extension method in the late 50s, early 60s, and we even incorporated in our program professors Keller, Edgar Keller, and Robert Haferkamp from Guatemala. So we shared Fred Bowden and Rudolf Blank from Venezuela, and myself, together with Keller and Haferkamp, had these extension, call it seminary, meetings and ways of preparing people in Venezuela, as I said, in the early 60s. Now you may ask, what are the advantages and what are the disadvantages? First of all, one thing that we have learned since we really tried to find out, well, how is education really carried out in Latin America? And especially in those areas where the population is predominantly Indian. Remember that in Guatemala, 55% are still pure Mayas. Pure Mayas, yes. So one has to check out, well, if somebody's going to serve amongst the Mayas, Indians, how do they train their leadership? Do they prepare or accept a leadership prepared outside of their milieu? And we found no. Amongst Indians, the only way to train a leader is within the tribe. It is by the day-by-day working, planning, struggling, fighting. That's how the leader is trained, prepared, and accepted. Some of the Indians that moved out of the tribe and received training in Guatemala City, for instance, and then after having gone to school and having brought back great ideas on how to improve maybe farming or whatever it is, found that when they returned to the tribe, they remained ostracized. They were suspect because they were bringing back ideas. And believe it or not, you know what ideas were most feared by, and still are, by Indian tribes? To this day, they will say the new ones that come in, they are trying to bring us ideas that corrupt us with this materialistic world. Materialism. We, of course, would look upon the Indian as backward because he doesn't want to share and enter into our mode of thinking and in our type of society that lets consumerism rule us. Materialism that is the center of our lives. And maybe today we can even laugh and say, look at Russia, the communist ideology that said it would destroy capitalism. It is bowing. It is joining us. It also finds that in the material goods and satisfying these for the people, there seemingly will be peace, satisfaction. And that way Gorbachev can avoid the struggles that he has in his own. See how the system works. I would only say, dear friends, let us heed Christ's warning. Woe and beware of that broad road that leadeth to destruction, and many that go in thereat. Certainly I'm not against the good things in life. They are gifts of God. But if we allow ourselves to be sucked into making our goals mostly materialistic and judging the world by its materialistic successes, whoa. What makes the United States so attractive to Latin America and to the rest of the world? Friends, it hurts me to say, it is only our material goods, our style of life, that is so attractive that even preachers like Schwagert in his former day was able to say that the next thing to heaven was life in the United States. That is the picture of heaven, life in the United States. The goodies, you know. But who of them wants to come to the United States to learn about love, mercy, compassion, and sharing? I'm ashamed to say, that is not what they're looking for. Because I'll say it, because I must. In Latin America right now, for those who are with it, the enemy, their enemy, to keep them from moving ahead is not Russia. It is the United States with its views on keeping its role in our life in Mexico, Central America, and South America. And you say what you're talking out of both sides of your mouth. So attractive the United States, yes, for its material goods. And so unattractive? Yes, exactly. Because precisely our way of doing things is what they feel keeps them from getting the material goods. For that reason, we are the enemy. In Latin America, we have no congregation that can afford to salary a seminary graduate. In Latin America, we have no student that can support his residence study program. What then? We have to look very seriously into this open theological education, this theological education by extension. And what are some of the advantages? Here are some books. First of all, I would highly recommend this book, Viability and Context, written by another graduate from this institution. His name is Herbert Zorn. It was written for the World Council of Churches trying to analyze theological education in the third world. And the subtitle is also very interesting. The Theological Seminary in the Third World, Seedbed or Sheltered Garden? Set us to thinking. Other books like An Extension Seminary Primer. This is in Dr. Hinsey's library. This one is from your library here, our library. Designing a Theological Education by Extension Program, a Philippine Case Study. Ministry by the People, Theological Education by Extension, edited by Ross Kindler. Excellent individual who entered the program totally against it. There was one man opposed to the method of theological education by extension. He confesses that he was totally won over by it. For me, he's one of the, in a sense, like a Paul, you know, totally against Christ and Christianity, and then becoming such an advocate for Christ and his ministry. Competent Ministry, A Guide to Effective Continuing Education. So there are books that are in your own library here. Here's another one by Ross Kindler, The Extension Movement in Theological Education. The advantage, I would say, for us in Latin America is this. Since we cannot afford a salaried pastor. Since students cannot afford to go to a resident seminary, the Extension Seminary trains leaders that are already self-supporting and are already accepted in their community. The congregation that often has to wait for a missionary to come every second week or every third week because the missionary cannot cover all of the territory, they will say, "But Pastor, couldn't we have somebody in our group lead us, guide us during the weeks that you aren't there?" So the group will ask, "Well, who could do it?" And in the group over prayer, they will talk and say, "I think Jose Martinez could do it." Then they will talk to Jose Martinez. Jose Martinez undoubtedly enjoys in that group respect. He's a man who has raised his family, who has shown leadership ability. And Jose Martinez could say, "But I really don't know. If I could get some help, I would be glad to do it." And so, since he's already in a leadership role, has already led the group, he then accepts this guidance and he receives this training. And one of the advantages in theological education by extension, it never ceases. They are continuing students. In Mexico, we have said to the students that are now serving already in parishes, every year we invite you to share, and it's more than an inviting. That inviting is really, we expect you to be there, 2 courses every year which are given. We have pastors that graduated 25 years ago in Mexico and haven't cracked the book since then. Haven't cracked the book. So these fellows keep on cracking a book every year. You know, so I would just like to see a system that continues to encourage people to remain abreast, to remain with it, to keep their eyes open to new situations as they develop. The disadvantages could well be that they don't have the interaction with others like you would have at a seminary like this. And I don't only mean drink beer together or play games together, but talk, discuss. But that can also be remedied. Remember, these people are working people so that they cannot really leave their work and go to a residence program. They continue to work as they study on weekends. But then we have retreats on occasions, weekends, so that that interaction can also take place. Now, how is it done? It's done by correspondence. It is done through radio cassettes, and it is done by video cassettes. I understand that Reverend Douglas Grohl came and talked to some of you a couple of weeks ago about the Hispanic program that is going on in 8 centers here in the United States. What a privilege! This weekend I'll be in Cleveland helping Reverend Grohl in one of these programs. Eventually I hope to be one that will prepare a course on Hosea, a course on the Psalms, whatever it is, if he can find room for me in that program. Because not only will we be using this program in the United States, but also in Mexico and in the rest of Latin America. I will now just bring it back a little bit to life here in the States. I understand that in 1920, it took about 80 communicants in the USA to support a pastor. In 1990, I am told it takes about 250 communicants. How many communicants will it take in the year 2000? In the year 2025. In 1950, when I studied here, it took about 800 a year to study at the seminary. Am I right, Horace? Or was it much more? I don't know. I think it was around that because I earned about 600, and that's all we could. Otherwise, we would have had to pay income tax. And then we got the rest from parents. In 1990, I don't know how much it takes, how much you have to pay for. In the year 2000, what will it be? All I keep on hearing is that a number of you are finishing in debt by studying. through these studies. And if there's one clamor I hear one way or other, is precisely how expensive it is becoming to study and prepare for the holy ministry. I then there ask, what will become of this institution in the year 2050 if students can no longer afford to study here? Remember, I'm talking to you as one who was at an institution that had to close. Only the Lord knows. From experience, however, allow me to suggest you continue to welcome changes. The road not taken could make all the difference, writes the poet Robert Frost. So if we don't quite understand where theological education by extension fits in Latin America, just please keep your mind open. It might be the way that God has in store for theological education, even through this august and loved institution. 1992 is just 3 years away, when we will either regret or celebrate 500 years of Christian presence in the Americas. 1995, however, marks 100 years the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod began work in India. And the year 2000 is the 100th year of work in Brazil. Friends, I challenge you to become involved and see how these dates, 1992, 1995, and the year 2000, can become a way of reviewing history and be a challenge for you and me to be more in God's mission. Here, there, and everywhere, for the Lord wants all to be saved and come to the knowledge of the truth. Thank you. Any questions? We are able to train deacons, evangelists, catechists, and pastors. And every one of these is under the supervision of a local pastor or missionary.
So they always stay part-time working at the same time as they're serving.
Right. In a sense, they work full-time. It's their sustenance, you see, and serve. In some cases, two lay people, persons, will serve in the same congregation because not one can't do the whole work. And I think that the more that join in a team ministry, the better. If I would like to just dream, what could for us in Latin America be the year 2025? That the congregation would call five lay people, lay persons, you know, and according to their gifts. One, the gift of administration, another one, a gift with dealing with youth, another one, of visitation, another one, of preaching, or whatever it be. And since all of them are working, are receiving their pay, you know, I mean, our sustenance through their work, it's obvious that the congregation will know that they can't demand that one individual carry out all of the functions. And so amongst the four or five that are dealing in a congregation. But each one then, in prayer and weekly coming together, they will be sharing. They will be sharing responsibilities. They will be talking to each other, you see. And it's a shared ministry. So I would hope, and I feel one of the things, that this seminary was always strong, and at least in my day, to prepare us to do everything. Only one individual, you know, which was so contrary to the team ministry concept. And I think I myself have a difficult way of just changing my thinking. How could I give up this? I who have learned to know it all, and you know, so, no. The priesthood of all believers is as much a doctrine of Scripture revered by Lutherans, pointed out by Luther, as Christ dying for us and Christ living in us. And the Christ in us and each layman can make of him and her more than I can ever think of, if we'd only let it happen. And we have to, in moments of dire need, which we are going through, especially in Central America right now with its wars, continued wars, we have to think wider and broader than our concepts sometimes of ministry, even the role of women in the church there. Am I answering your question? Or are there still...
No, that's pretty good. Mm-hmm.
I think it's important in this connection to think about time periods. For example, my experience in New Guinea was working there when there were no seminaries. Working there when there was one seminary, the vernacular seminary. And then working there when there were two seminaries, the vernacular seminary, and then Martin Luther Seminary out of LA, where the men were trained in Hebrew and Greek and the whole works. And there are periods of time in individual areas, nations, and you have the ability to have what we would call the fully trained clergy, and there are times when you have a whole number of laity getting equipped and doing any number of things under a missionary or whatever, that later on, when you have pastors, the pastors will be doing more of it.
Yeah, I'd like to share you another side of the story. I have to tell you that our seminary in Hong Kong had failed the extension program. You know, during the 1970s, suddenly, the mission board of the United States talked to Hong Kong and said, you should be independent now. So, we write out our institution, and then just I was in a seminary at that time, second year, after almost, second year and the third year. And then suddenly, the president of the Concordia Seminary in Hong Kong,
what's his name?
President Kirk. And suddenly he said, okay, how can the congregation afford a full-time pastor then? So, we write out an extension program. So you come, instead of to come to study in the daytime, you come to the evening. And so you go out the daytime to look for jobs and look for training. In case when you graduate, then you have your job in the daytime and then you serve your congregation without any salary. And money paid by the congregation. It's a good idea at first. So I go back to the teacher's college in the government college and to be trained as a teacher, a certified teacher. You have to be trained in the government college, teacher's college, so that you can teach. So I teach. In the daytime, I went to the teacher's college. In the evening, I went to the seminary to study theology. You know what happened after I graduated? One of my schooling, because he got a teacher's certificate, the salary is better than the money better than to get the money from the congregation. So he quit. He don't want to be a pastor. And the other one also paid because of the job. And later on, a lot of teachers in our school coming to the evening program and to be trained. Actually, in their mind, they like to be a principal of a school in our school. We have about 20 schools in Hong Kong. So, because the salary are paid by the government in our school. So the principal right now at in the middle school, we have $3,000 a month, US dollar a month for the principal. So attractive. So the church decided, okay, we maintain their as a pastor, as a principal, so they serve in the school as a principal, and also they have a church, but they only preach on Sunday, that's all. So suddenly, those pastors only have the name as a pastor, actually they are teachers, they are pastors. They don't have a kind of sacrificing ministry heart to serve to the church. And so the church are fighting for the position of the school, rather searching the way to serve the church. So the extension, we are very good for other people coming in, but at the same time we destroy the real good, how we sacrifice our life to serve the church. How we maintain to have a position in the daytime and try to serve the church at the same time. God and wife one hand and the other hand among the world. See, that's something we have to consider also.
I remember Bernd's thesis as one of the highlights of the reading that that was shared at a given moment. And of course, what it signified in the thinking of the seminary education in Hong Kong at the time. I think it was used even as a model outside of Hong Kong, at least as a daring step of trying to face a situation. You present, of course, a very tragic picture of what happened to those who were in extension seminaries, but maybe leaving out what happened to those who were trained through a resident program, who through the love of money and the greed for money also left the ministry. So, to me, a fair picture would only be if we put the two side by side. Because to become greedy for money is not only for one who is trained through the extension program. It is equally a danger for those who are trained through a residence program. And because of the love of money being the root of all evil, many have gone the way of that flesh, either just in name serving and really not being a pastor. So I think, to be fair, I know you've been, not right now, you describe yourself as a victim of that program. But I think what is important would be the overall objective of the program. To include people that have a calling, even though they are, call it, active in another ministry, which is honorable by God, and serving people, be it during the day and weekends in the church. And it has a role that it could play, and it's an important one for us. In Latin America right now, with our horribly weak economic situation, it just is one of those avenues which we cannot discard. With all of the risks that when an individual, through his daily means, receives an income, he may just say, goodbye, church, I'm going to dedicate myself there because nobody else is helping. Would you have a question?
I saw a statistic for Venezuela that some incredible proportion of the population is below age 25 in Latin America. I suppose
more than half of the population in all of our Latin American countries is less than 15 years of age.
My question is regarding that population and the Ministry of Christian Schools. What is education like in Latin America, secular school-age children education? What efforts are there for Christian education, and what impediments are there for Christian education?
Venezuela, for instance, where I served, has a large school of about 500 students, and more than half of those are in secondary education. One of the sad part of that history is I have not seen as yet anyone coming out of that school, what we would call inactive ministry for the church. So we have schools in Guatemala too, in Puerto Barrios, Acapa. We have a smaller one in Quetzaltenango. Christian schools that train people, and I would say the experience in Zacapa especially, would have the potential of incorporating in its secondary training theological education to train people for ministry, which they are thinking about, they're planning. And then from there, they could make another step. After having trained 2 years in Zacapa, they could enroll in a school in Guatemala City and continue theological education and have then, let's say, that program prepare them for a full ministry. It's not used as much as we could and ought.
If it was a disaster for us to try to impose the model of theological education in the U.S., on Latin America, do you see any possibility that it might be a disaster if we try to impose the Latin American model on the North American situation?
If it's an imposition, yes. I'm only suggesting, think about it. I'm not imposing. Just keep it in mind. Keep it in your back pocket. That's all.
Does this kind of program have any kind of standard, or is it just, you know, wherever the person's at in their walk, they just plug into the system, or there are goals and standards to be reached, you know, a certain confession, or is it just, you know, I feel like in administration, you know, I take a couple of classes and now I'm an administrator, you know, I take a Hosea class and now I'm an Old Testament teacher, or is there a standard or guidelines for this kind of program that kind of keep it on track rather than kind of everybody doing their own thing?
Yes. Each one of these schools, like in Venezuela, for instance, has its program, and it has different levels. Training catechists, evangelists, pastors. And depending also on the level of preparation, there are courses that are prepared at their various levels. And there's a method of which courses to take first that are introductory, that are preparing you to come to understand the world you live in and also how to apply scripture to the world you live in. And there's rhyme. There's an objective. There's a policy. There's a goal. And there's method. It's not just helter-skelter. We have very defined curriculum that we... And then, of course, the continued education builds on that. I will not tell them I have a course will travel. No. They will tell me what they need, and then I am asked. And I ask them, give me a month or so to prepare, and I will travel. So I try to fit their needs, not what I have, you know. And that's the way we try to. Some courses are better taught in different test systems and methods, you know. So that's where... And I'm not the only one doing it. We have in Latin America David Brandes, a colleague in Mexico. We have John Durkovic, who just left and came back to the States. And we have Rudolf Blank, who is now in California at Fuller getting his doctorate there. So then continuing, he does the same thing as a roaming teacher.
I guess my question would be, for how long have you had this program implemented, and at what levels have you had people move to, and at each level do you have some type of competency, theological interview that they're ready for the next step, or you know, how do they proceed up on the line?
Mm-hmm. In Venezuela, we started in 1958. Right?
So you have pastors that have...
Yes. Not that many. No. But they are fulfilling other roles, too. Teachers, evangelists, catechists, you see. Venezuela, unfortunately, with all of the missionaries that we have there, has produced very few pastors. But one of them went to Korea. He is the president of the church in Venezuela. Alcides Franco, who went together with Dana Bronis, who is the missionary counselor of Venezuela. But Alcides Franco is a product from beginning to end of the Extension Seminary program. And he now is a teacher in it. And he continues to study in it. See, so it's, he teaches, he studies, continues. A marvelous individual. Keeps one humble. You know, it's what it's all about. There's no saying, which, it's one of the nice things in extension seminaries. There's, oh, do you have this? No, we're all students. We're all learning. We haven't learned enough yet. And we sometimes get scared of titles, you know, and where one came from and what one did. That doesn't impress people too much, you know, when they haven't really lived the situation like in Salvador where they fear death every day.
The title isn't important, but the preparation is. Do you use a testing method?
Well, sure.
Or do you do the interview yourself, or who does this?
No, I just a guest that comes there. The local pastor does too.
Pastors that are, you know, we have directors of programs. As I said, Venezuela has an extension seminary. Has its director, has its professors, has its students. I'm a guest that come there. I'm tested by them, but I don't test. I don't know whether I'm answering you. We do have. I mean, it isn't just helter-skelter. It isn't wild and woolly, you know, just doing what you want to. Even though it may sound the way I talk is shooting off the hip. No, it's taking each situation, and it's not as neat as you have here with your examination periods and graduations and, you know, and maybe some who didn't in May, you know, will do it, you know. No, we constantly, it's a roll with the punches. And we don't have, with revolution in Central America, we just don't have schedules of that nature. People are dying and funerals galore, you know. And yet 70 people will come to my courses, which I will teach in the morning for those who are working in the afternoon and evenings, or I will teach in the afternoon for those who are working nights or what, or in the evenings, three times. And half of those people will come from what we call behind the lines, where the guerrillas are at it, you know, risking their lives to cross and come to these courses. So it's the situations of, and the last, not the last, one of the last times I was there, one of my students was murdered on Wednesday. His name is David Fernandez. Horribly mutilated. Where Bishop Medardo Gomez, his own friend, and it was the person that brought, really, Medardo Gomez into the Lutheran Church, had to verify how he saw him strangulated. Well, the description is just beyond how he found him in a gully. To say this is the fellow who helped me come into the church. But three funeral services were held. 2,000 Union people came to the one service because he was one of the advisors of several unions in the town of San Miguel. 2,000 of these people came to pay their respects. And the hope of the resurrection was proclaimed by Bishop Medardo Gomez. And then the worship in the home, and then the worship service. So those are the type of things. I didn't go, because I had 70 people that had come from all parts of the country, so I couldn't be at both places. So those are the tensions that we... And if it's not always so neat and tidy as, you know, it's just circumstance. But I think we celebrate the living Lord as God will permit in varied situations.
I'm just going to add, I visited Venezuela a couple of years ago and had the opportunity of sitting in on TEE classes being taught by Rudy Blanc in Puerto Ordaz. One was a course on the Book of Acts, exegetical course, another was a doctrine course, and there is regular testing, and there is, you know, you either pass or you fail the course, and there is opportunity for people who, if they get bogged down with family concerns or whatever, and are doing poorly in the course, to take it over until they do get it right and meet the satisfactory standard. Alcides was, when I was down there, a third-year graduate of a six-year program. He had attained that level. It was recognized. It was publicly, whatever, certified by the missionaries and by the Evangelical Lutheran Church of Venezuela. So there is, definite organization, structure, levels. And I believe at that time they only had three pastors. One was supporting himself, he was an economist, another was a farmer, and I don't know what Alcides was doing besides pastoring or people.
Oh, he was so many excellent things. He worked in the aluminum factory, he worked in the steel factory, and I think accounting was one of the things that he did amongst other things.
Well, we want to thank you very much for being with us today.